Thomas, do you see that new patron, Alexander Longwell? How do you pronounce an A with umlaut? What's that sound like?
The Brothers. You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wisp. Let's take a ride through space.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wisp, number 101. Man, I am still hungover from the 100 episode. We have so many people, and it took so long to edit it. But joining us today is Thomas Kiernek from Slovakia.
Hello, everyone.
We've got Nick Arellano from... You're still... Where are you at?
I'm lost in Illinois right now.
Lost in... Sounds like you're lost in Illinois somewhere. So you just, you know, just
That's
somewhere.
That's basically what it is.
All right. And then we've got T-Cent. Where are
you?
Hey,
guys.
You're in Colorado, right?
Yeah, northeastern Colorado.
Northeastern. Is that the best part of Colorado? Do you guys... Or is it all just...
No, Colorado is a beautiful state as long as you don't consider northeastern Colorado or the western slope.
Seems kind of carved.
It's all flat. I love flat and the plains, but no one else in the world likes it, so that's fine. I'll take what I have and appreciate it.
That reminds me of an uncle of mine. He grew up in like East Texas in the Piney Woods, right, with these big giant pine trees. And he said he started driving west one day, and then all of a sudden he could see the sky, not just straight up above him. And he's like, I think I should probably live here. And so then he just moved there. There you go. So, you know, there's something to be said about actually being able to see the world around you every now and then. See the skyline, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I couldn't live anywhere that's more humid than Colorado, because I hate, like, that foggy mist. I love being able to see my horizon in all 360 degrees.
All right, well, rock and roll. Let's get the vegetables out of the way so we can get to the fun stuff. We have a couple of new patrons this week. I'll put an air horn in here, right there, air horn there. All right, we have, and I'll pronounce it. I'll give a swing at it, and then Thomas is going to be kind enough to. it's our first Austrian, Alexander Langle. Or how would you guess we're going to pronounce this, Thomas?
I think it's Langle or Langle, either of those.
Langley. All right. Either way, Alexander's pretty vocal right out of the bat, you know, running and gunning. I think it's pretty cool. We've also got a new kid named Jeff Haynes. That one I probably didn't butcher. So again, it's we have a Patreon account, patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You jump in there, you throw us some bones, and you can get access to the Little Brothers with Slack. And to be honest with you, I was telling somebody the other day, that's kind of the only human contact other than my wife and kids I have on a day-to-day basis, so it's that's nice. And you guys aren't all complete weirdos, just, you know, half of us are.
A little bit.
So, you know, you get a little good mix of all kind, and I love the international people, too. They have a different slant. Thomas is always railing about GDPR and how important it is. You know, no, I mean, that's something we don't think about over here, right? You guys have a whole host of problems, and... Well, not necessarily problems. Sometimes it's advantages. A lot of times it's advantages. But I love the juxtapositions, the viewpoints, all that good stuff. So, what should we start about first? I just get some little stuff. George A. the other day, actually it was probably about 2 weeks ago, had a cheap single mode OTDR. That's a optical time domain reflectometer. I think is what it is. It sends laser light down a piece of fiber optic cable. It looks for the reflections to come back and times all of that stuff. So it can give you an idea of where connectors are, where brakes are, where heavy bends are, things like that. He found one that's like $400. I've actually kind of been looking for one, fishing around. He says this one's pretty good so far. I'm curious to see. Hopefully he'll hear this and then he'll chime in and say, I thought this was really good or not. Somebody was saying it doesn't do multi-mode. To which I was thinking, well, I don't really do multi-mode either, so it's not a big deal. Like, if I'm doing multi-mode fiber, I'm doing it with a couple of chassis sitting right next to each other. And if the fiber doesn't work, I'm not going to test it. I'm just going to throw it in the trash and put a new one in, right? Because the stuff's so inexpensive these days. But the single-mode stuff, definitely if I'm doing kind of building-to-building or if I'm doing outdoor fiber, you know, like kind of over distance, I'm always doing single-mode. So if I had a little $400 piece of kit that I could just... I don't know about you, but the back of my car, so I drive like a kind of a hatchback, kind of a bubble butt car, and there's like all kinds of little stuff Tetris together, and then I put a blanket over it, so it would fit in nicely over on the left side where I keep all of my tools, like kind of hidden under there. So Do you guys have need for a small OTDR that you could just kind of stash away?
I do. And so last spring, right before the Austin Mum, my boss and I thought we were cutting some old fiber that was no longer in use, but it was actually looped back and fed half of our network. And so, yeah, it was like the day before, or 2 days before I left for Austin. I was like, oh shit, I'm not going to Austin because I have to figure out how to. And we didn't have a fiber splicer, so we got super lucky, and one of our neighbor Wisps, who we're super good friends with, sent a guy over and he fixed it for us, and so we were only down for a couple hours, but oh god, it was horrible. And I was telling Justin Miller about that on our car ride into Austin, and he's like, oh hey, here's this super cheap fiber splicer that's super awesome, and so now I own that, and I'm probably going to pick up one of these because we don't have an OTDR either, and it's like, this is stupid, we should have this stuff if we have fiber and if we're going to be doing a project. So the one negative I saw for this is that it doesn't have the LC connector, which is all we run. It's like, god.
Yeah, it seems like that. Virtually every VFL, right, which is a visual fault locator, mm-hmm. It just sends a really bright laser, and you could see bins and shit. Those and OTDRs always seem to have SC connectors or ST, like one or the other. I've never seen one with like a nice LC connector sitting right there. But they make little adapters. They're like 1 inch long, right? That go whatever to whatever, mm-hmm. for these testers. So it's not. I mean, you'll lose a little light, and the OTDR, I'm sure, will pick it up right there. Well, I mean, it would pick up the connector anyway. So now it's just going to pick up two connectors. I guess it's not the worst thing in the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there could be worse. It could be worse. I could not have one at all.
Yeah. That reminded me of two stories. One is we were trying to find a break in some fiber, but not all of the fiber was broke. So what we did is we shot an OTDR down one of the working fibers, and the closest splice case we thought it was to, we went in there and then we bent a fiber, that fiber, and then looked on the OTDR where the reflection was, right? Because it picked it up, and we're like, oh, it's 555 feet from this point. And so then we could really easily just kind of walk back where it was, and that helped. But when you were talking about decommissioning stuff, back, oh man, what was this? 2003 or 4, I used to work for a place called UCS, and we had a bunch of old copper phone lines in there because we had a Rome telephone system. It was ancient. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like several refrigerators stuck together for this big building we were in. Well, we decommissioned all that stuff and went to VoIP, and so they wanted to pull out all the copper. And it was all that 25-pair stuff. So this guy, David, I'm not going to say his last name, but David was in there after hours, and he was cutting that stuff. And then some of it was still in use by a call center. And he goes, oh, man. He calls me at like 8 at night and says, hey, we cut this stuff. And I was like, what do I do? And I said, okay, well, you're going to meet me up there at 5 in the morning and we'll repair it all, right? Because the call center doesn't open until 7. And he goes, oh, okay. And then I go back to whatever I was doing. And 20 minutes later, he calls me and goes, hey, I cut another one. I was like, are you kidding me?
Oh, no.
I was like, put the pliers down. Stop. You know, now you get to meet me at 3 in the morning. And we started scrambling towards the end and weren't, I mean, we were just like twisting and taping, twist tape, just going as fast as we could. The fun part is he prepped all the cable for me by removing all the jacket as far as we could get to. And so it's yeah, okay, yeah. The 25 pair, it's two sets of cable that look identical inside, and it's just the inner wrappings that identify them as one or the other. So we didn't know which one was going to which, and luckily everything that was in use actually got paired up right. So it was a very fortunate morning. Golly, David, I haven't thought about that incident in quite a while. I actually still have one of the knots. Whenever they went through and pulled them out, it's like a piece of cable with a big giant electrical tape ball on it. I have it somewhere. They brought it to me like years later when it finally got completely pulled out. Good times, though.
Yeah. Oh. That, speaking of phone cables, I just did an install for this guy who was a previous CenturyLink employee, and he used to do fiber all over the place. So I'm going to make him one of my friends. And his house was hooked up. There was Cat 5e ran everywhere. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And so I figure out where it's run. It's all in this cabinet or closet. And it's all spat out in from the wall. And it's all wire wrapped together with those electrical nuts. And it's like, what the heck is going on here? Like, what electrician was going on? And I find where they're spitting out. And they're all spitting out to phone jacks. And that was how the electrician had done all his home runs for the phone system for this house that's like 5 years old. I was like, what the heck? Who runs phone, one, and two, who runs Cat 5e for phone lines? Like, that's whatever. So, but it made my life super easy. So I got to run. I just terminated it with normal Ethernet jacks. And, but even all the way out to where CenturyLink was coming in, had been coming in with phone lines, it's... was Cat 5e. And it's like, what the heck is this stuff? So, it was nice. The guy stripped like 3 inches of copper, so I'm guessing they had lots of issues with their phone lines too. But not anymore with their internet. But golly, Ned, yeah. Electricians, never let them do Cat 5e.
No, it gets pretty scary. I've seen them tie knots in it. You know, like drill holes and studs and tie knots so that you can't pull it through, you know, just to, like, keep it there and just do interesting stuff like that.
Yeah.
Definitely never let them terminate. I've seen some. I've undone a lot of heartache from that before.
If you've got copper to copper, it's fine, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You just doesn't matter what you do to the twists.
good times. All right, so we have WISP in the name of this podcast, but I don't think we talk enough about wireless stuff. So I saw a lot of information going back and forth on the Cambium channel that actually lit up this in the last few weeks. I haven't seen that much action going on in there. A couple of the takeaways, and again, I'm not a guy who runs personally Cambium stuff, but I actually have a couple of customers that do, and you guys are pretty active on there. But one of the things I noticed was people were saying the Cambium 3000 access points that they've had problems. Apparently there's firmware issues, maybe something akin to that, and they've couple of guys have actually removed them from their network until those issues get resolved. So anybody who's thinking about the 3000s, ask around, maybe talk to some people before you go and pull the trigger on that one. And then also I saw a couple of guys say that firmware version 4.4.2 has been pretty good. I'm doing air quotes, pretty good. They haven't had any problems with it thus far. So another customer of mine that I was talking to said that they were looking to roll to that. So that's good news. I'm assuming with the Cambium stuff, it's not the full meal deal. You can piecemeal, right? You can roll like an access point and test for a little while. I'm hoping that's what most people do, right? People do that, right?
Yeah, it's just hard to... It's like most of these problems, it kind of depends on like the load and like, I don't know, how they have things kind of laid out. So it gets weird because for most of the vendors, when I used to run the WISP was... It's kind of like a dance. You'd have to like look on the forums and see like who's tried it already and tried on a small pop. Especially with a lot of the Ubiquiti stuff, we had a lot of problems where firmware would break stuff or a lot of different waves of GPS sync problems, and it's not fun.
I guess that could be an interesting problem wherein you take your smallest access point, because that's the one you want to test with, right? Because it would impact the fewest number of people, and it doesn't have enough load to actually expose whatever problem there is in the firmware, so then you start rolling it everywhere else. That could be problematic.
Yeah, I mean, I have a whole tower. I mean, admittedly, I don't run any Cambium, but like, I just have a tower that has all the different types of systems that I run across the whole network, and all my customers there know that occasionally they are in the testing realm, and I'm really nice to them, and they all have my cell phone number, so when things go bad, I find out about it quick and can step back. But, I mean, I don't know. It just seems like that would be a good system. But, I mean, if you have a super heavy load, even on, like, the Mimosa stuff that I have for testing, occasionally I'll see people on the forums with, like, super high numbers of customers, and then it's difficult to figure out. But I think a couple of the guys, they were... finding that some of their issues were bad SMs or bad connections with the SMs, is what I'm reading, was reading this today. But yeah, the an SM with a lot of retransmits.
Yeah, I heard somebody also saying something like they had one or two subscriber modules having problems connecting, and then they just changed the frequency they were in, or they changed the channel, and then everything was fine and everybody connected. So I guess it was interference issues from those two.
That's the new Ubiquiti AC gear. I am addicted to that stuff because it has extreme, with the extra radio on there that you can do site monitoring, you can do the air view in real time without disconnecting the client. Oh my gosh, it's been so nice for hunting down noise issues. That's like, I can spend hours on that for, and it saves me so much time making channel decisions and bouncing people around on and playing musical chairs with channels, which you always do. If once you change one access point, you got to go changing a bunch of others. Well, at least, I mean, for
it's never set it and forget it, right? It's a living environment, and if it changes, right, you want to be able to test it, right?
Yeah, that's, well, and I think you're quoting me from my five tips all those months ago. Always monitor the heck out of your wireless network, because, I mean, that thing, there's all sorts of things that move, and there's so many moving parts. So, yeah. I mean, that's just my opinion.
I think you guys, you wireless guys, are more akin to witch doctors than you are engineers. There's a lot of animal sacrifice involved, a lot of chanting.
Whoa. We speaking are not guys who make printers work. Those guys are real witch doctors, and they make voodoo work. I have a couple of those people on speed dial for whenever a customer runs into printer issues, because I cannot figure that stuff out.
God. I cannot bring myself to go to that person and figure the problem out. Maybe that's step one, is still having, I don't know, man. I'm just too old. I've done that desktop support stuff for too long. I can't bring myself to do it anymore.
I can't blame you. It's that there's some fun in like, oh, a new problem, figure it out. But it's just like, you're always hunting down new issues. Yeah, you're right. That's why I have a printer guy who is amazing and good. And if I had his card here, I would put it out to the world and have everyone call him for their printer issues. And then he'd hate me. But, yeah. Well, and then also people were talking about what happened with Cambium and their stock dropping at the same time Ubiquiti went sky high.
I don't know. Was that Chad who was saying that he read the report and it didn't look very bad? Like, yeah, he didn't really see anything. I guess they just maybe perhaps didn't hit the numbers that were anticipated or something like that.
Oh, yeah. They were short on revenue.
Also, Ubiquiti stock, while it was about a 25% increase, it really wasn't. It was just reclaiming previous losses. So there was a big Ubiquiti stock jump, and that was due to their fiscal quarter. They reported much higher profit than anticipated by analysts. So it was really just an adjustment back, slightly under previous levels still.
Yeah. It's a jump up of like $45, and it hadn't been that high since May, I think.
Yeah, if you look at the evolution of the Ubiquiti stock over time, you know, there's been huge upwards jumps and there's been huge downwards jumps. So for the past couple of months, it was rather low, and now it jumped back up to almost its previous average levels.
Yeah. So if you have Ubiquiti stock, watch out to see if they get nailed for GDPR. And as soon as you hear those rumblings, sell.
All right. So while we're talking about that, you introduced the idea. I've got kind of a stack of Ubiquiti stuff. Let's talk about that. Why not jump into the GDPR, and then we'll talk about the hardware.
Right.
So, Thomas, I think you were the first one to actually post this in here, because you're a GDPR watchdog. For the group, obviously. You're the most European of all the Europeans. Take that for what it's worth.
Well, I mean, he's got a software as a service product, and he has to worry about those types of things too, and that's where he lives. So Thomas. So if I have all of the customer data anonymized and stored on encrypted disks, I'm fully compliant, right?
Yeah, that depends.
Well, first let's talk about what exactly we're talking about, right? So Ubiquiti did a firmware update, and I don't even know what product. I can't even remember at this point. But it's
Unify all across the Unify line.
Yikes. Okay. And so by default now, and there's no way to, from what I understand, other than creating a firewall rule to block it, some statistical information is being sent back to Ubiquiti, right?
So, yeah. So first of all, realistically, this has nothing to do with GDPR. Because it affects also US customers and everybody else. Of course, there is a GDPR angle to it. But yeah, what happened is Ubiquiti completely stealthily or silently introduced a new data collection feature across all of Unify, which there have been no announcements, there have been no mentions of this in the changelog, there has been no communication. And basically all Unify Kit now collects a lot of statistical data about their customers, which actually includes MAC addresses of the access point, MAC addresses of the clients, airtime, how much data the clients transferred, how long they were connected for. Of course, the device is fully identified with serial numbers and everything else. So basically Ubiquiti just, like, you know, without a word to anyone, started collecting a whole lot of user identifiable, and you could argue if this is sensitive data or if it's not, but it's certainly a lot of statistical analytical data that started collecting.
Right. I mean, the idea of, I mean, them saying that they're anonymizing it, that's great and all, but theoretically, if they're sending back serial numbers, MAC addresses, you could trace down what individual product was bought by a user, right? And then that information could be, I mean, you could really, at that point, tie it back to who that individual person is. But honestly,
see, this is the problem, right?
Done, right?
Yeah, it was also, you know, there is levels of anonymization, right? What does it mean they anonymize the data? And this is the part of the problem, right? The lack of communications. People don't know what's even being collected from their networks and from their devices, which for enterprises and any security-minded people that have audits and compliance is obviously a huge issue.
Absolutely.
Right? So basically what we know is all from reverse engineering and from studying the binaries on the devices and the data that's being submitted. So we still don't know even all of the scope of the collection, or the community doesn't know. Ubiquiti has done zero communication on this, on what's being collected, how it's being collected, how it's being anonymized. They only said it is being anonymized.
They put out an official statement, but I mean,
it was a no statement.
I was gonna say, you might as well be reading the back of a cereal box for all the information they actually gave you.
It was a non statement, right? It was pure management crap.
It was
so that happened, caught, right? Yeah. So people, for hopefully obvious reasons, got fairly upset, and now we can get to the GDPR aspect of this. So Ubiquiti, of course, sells their products to Europe as well, and. So Ubiquiti said that this is being anonymized and it's being stored in an encrypted format, which is all nice and well. But and I want to prefix this that I am not a lawyer. And while I do deal with GDPR a lot because we are a software company and we also have, you know, a SaaS product and we run, you know, we sell our software online. So we deal with those personally and identifiable data. But still, I am not a lawyer. So in Europe, services like these, which collect any kind of personally identifiable data, which you can easily argue that a MAC address is, right? Any services like this, it's not just about anonymizing it and encrypted storage and other things, which they said they are compliant with. It's about their consent. So first of all, according to GDPR, any services like this must be opt-in, not opt-out.
Mm.
Which is super important because, first of all, Ubiquiti enabled this globally. across in firmware across the UniFi line. So currently there is no way to turn it off at all, which is a major GDPR breach. You know, you have a service which basically outputs your data somewhere, and you have no way to turn it off.
Come on, Thomas, just block it in the firewall. They said that simple stuff.
Yeah,
that's right. What they said. Yeah, you're more yeah. than you're more than able to block it if you want. There's nothing stopping you.
Yeah.
So first of all, we have to know that it exists. Which and actually, right. This is a funny story. So how the community or how people found out that this even happened. So we don't even know how. Well, now from retro analysis, you know which firmware it started in. But how people found out is because Ubiquiti screwed up and there was a memory leak in the statistics submitter. So devices would crash because they were running out of memory due to a memory leak in this in this statistics collector. So that's how people found out originally.
Wow.
But yeah, so first of all, Ubiquiti didn't announce this at all, which is a major GDPR breach. Second of all, it's enabled by default, which is a GDPR breach. And third of all, there is no way to turn it off, which it should not have been turned on in the first place. So that's three GDPR breaches right there, which Ubiquiti has done. Mm-hmm. And this is serious stuff. Like, you can see that their intent was not to announce this. Their intent was to introduce this steadily and enable it across the UniFi fleet, which I don't think is okay at all. It's a really bad idea. It's a really bad move, especially today in with all the privacy things that are going on. So yeah, it's a really big move from Ubiquiti, and it's in multiple breaches of GDPR.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna go out on a not very far limb here and say, because I always try and do this, is that I don't want to immediately assume malice, right? I don't immediately want to assume that they're all, you know, rubbing their grubby hands together about all this secret stuff that they're gonna start doing. To me, it seems more likely that somebody came up with this brilliant idea, then they just kind of shotgunned it into the firmware, and then all we're getting this cool information back, and maybe nobody, you know, at the right levels were really informed on what they were doing. You know, like maybe the legal team had no idea what was, you know what I mean? And just
but then, this stuff you got know, look at the response, right? The response was a non-response. Oh, this yeah. has been going on for a couple of weeks almost now, I think for at least a week, right? And you can see that they have completely, rather than handling it, they shut it down, the forum threads on the Ubiquiti new, I don't even know if you can call those new things the forums that Ubiquiti has, on the Ubiquiti community, the threads were locked. You know, there was a non-response submitted by them, and since then there hasn't been any announcement, there hasn't been any rectification yeah. of the problem. And I understand that this takes time, but you can see from how they approached the response to the problem, it's still, I don't think they're handling it well.
Yeah, I think I'm going to agree with you there. I don't think the response was, you know, trying to sweep it under the rug as quickly as possible is probably not the, I mean, they're dealing with internet nerds, so how far do they think they're going to get with this, you know, and actually be successful with just making it I mean, I can kind of see it. It's almost like, this is no big deal. Yeah, this is the thing. We're going to add a checkbox. Next firmware version, you'll be able to turn it off. No big deal. Right. So, just being very nonchalant.
See, the problem is now you have 200-300 devices across your network that you need to check the checkbox in, which is just plain stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think out of the gate, I don't think it was a malicious thing. Having said that, yeah, the response hasn't been. But I mean,
yeah, I don't think it was malicious either. Yeah, it's just stupid.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, but if the way that I feel about it too is like this type of thing isn't something like new. Like, there's been a lot of news coverage on like people's fear with Huawei products and a bunch of Chinese brand cameras phoning home. You know, a bunch of compromised firmware on other router vendors. It's been a common thing that people are concerned about. So the fact that they would just do this and assume it would be okay.
I don't know, brother. Especially humans have short memories.
Yeah.
Right. Do you still shop at Target after all their data breaches? And, you know, I mean, it's like,
right.
People mess up and we just forget. It's like, so suddenly we forget.
Yeah.
Like, Huawei is still selling so much. They probably sell more money worth of equipment in 5 minutes than I'll make in my entire life, right? So they're still, you know, I don't think those sorts of things really impact the manufacturers that vastly.
I'm just talking about the whole, you know, phoning home data collection type things that people are already kind of irked about, and then you take their product. But, you know, something like Target, they're a merchant going through a third-party system managed by somebody else. Someone like Ubiquiti, especially if you're buying enterprise gear, where they're making firewall appliances, and they're supposed to, you know, deal with security and a secure platform, and then now they're like, well, we're going to just start collecting all this data and just think nobody's going to notice. Yeah. I mean, it's just unprofessional.
And I mean, how many times have you seen Unify, and I'm not saying unexpected places, but I've seen it in like doctor's offices and things like that. And, you know, collecting people's information in those environments seems pretty suspect, you know? So yeah, well, I definitely get it.
Yeah, and like Thomas was saying too, if they have a compliance, are they supposed to just rip the equipment out now? Like, did they just lose, you know, that customer from buying the equipment? Because now, you know, it breaks their compliance. Now they have to replace it with something else pretty quick, or wait for them to, I don't know. It just seems like a really poor decision.
Yeah, maybe you can roll back to an old firmware or something.
Apparently it's really hard to do. And there are guys on the internet saying that they can't, that whatever industry they are in, they can't do it now. And that just sounds like normal internet threats. But also another thing is, I mean, I think we should kind of keep in mind is that initially it was, from the sounds of it, it was released for the beta, and then it probably just snuck into the default. It feels like this is supposed to be a beta feature for them to figure out beta issues, but then it went into normal channel and probably shouldn't have, because that's where the people started seeing it, the issue, and that's when it was like 3 weeks ago is when the first people were started running into issues. And then they fixed the memory bloat issue, but people were still like, why the heck is it talking to this? And it's trace.ui.com and then also ping.ui.com. If you're wanting to block the DNS queries, those are the ones to block.
That's another thing, that in their announcement, they actually said it was only trace.ui.com. Right, and then people through reverse engineering found out it's also ping.ui.com. So like even the official response to this was not entirely correct.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm trying to move away from Ubiquiti equipment already in some regards, and in some ways I'm stuck with it. But it's like, well, and also, but then again, also I'm in the middle of installing a Ubiquiti system for a customer, but they're dairy and I don't think they care, and I know I'm not going to care. So it kind of just depends on what industry you're in and how much you want to spend for somebody else.
Well, I think here's just a question I'll ask the group is, will this affect your buying decision on Ubiquiti stuff? Like, will this impact whether you're going to buy Unify Kit or not? I don't think it's really going to bother me. I'll wait until they clean up their whatever this is, and then, you know, if I need a Unify AP, I'll probably just pick one up. I don't know that it's necessarily going to change my buying decision.
Yeah, no, same here.
If I was talking about like an environment where there was some compliance issues, I mean, you know, maybe be a little gun shy, but I don't think I'm going to change. You don't think you will? How about you, Nick?
Well, I generally don't really like to deploy Unify products except like the camera system, but I don't know. I think if there was an option that had a similar user interface control, something that was easy for the customer to use, I would probably shift towards that, just because if they're going to repeatedly do stuff like this, that just kind of shows they don't care a whole lot. They'd rather like do the thing and apologize later. I don't know. If there was another alternative that was easy for a customer to manage, I would probably switch products, but there's just not a lot out there that's just as good around the same price point.
Mm. You're not a Unify guy, are you, Thomas?
I have never deployed anything other from Ubiquiti other than the edge switches, which we have also now stopped deploying. So for me, it's complicated, but yeah, for the Air Max platform, I have played with it multiple times to see how they progress with, you know, from 5 to 6, 7, 8, and ROS development and ROS features, but Ubiquiti is just, I have never deployed it because it just doesn't complete my list of equipment requirements that I have for any serious production grade use. You know, like, for those of you that listen for longer, it used to be that even MikroTik CRS switches didn't actually check all the boxes on my requirements
list.
For a really long time for production grade equipment. And just ROS, I don't think will ever be there because they are designing it in a different way. It's for a different use case. It's for a different target market. It's for different people other than me. So I have never deployed any ROS Air Max systems. I have never deployed any Unify systems again because I am not the target audience, right? I know what I am doing. Unify doesn't, again, check all the boxes that I needed for serious production grade uses. So yeah. As I said, I deployed some edge switches for a while until we found the better solutions. Those were okay, and they are still okay products. It's just that now I have found better alternatives. But other than that, I very much don't do Ubiquiti, not because I don't like them, but because they manufacture stuff for a different target audience than I am.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think, and this is just musings, you know, do you think that their response would have been different if they weren't a publicly traded company?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Right? It's like, you know, that whole empathy thing, right? You try and look through their eyes. You know, if people's opinions, you know, didn't vastly affect how my company was doing day to day, would I be a little bit more transparent about stuff like that, you know? And maybe a little bit quicker to, you know, just step up and be very transparent about what happened. I don't know. It's curious.
Well, see, the issue is in Europe with GDPR. This is a huge issue for anybody running Unify, because if you don't know that this is enabled by default, then you are responsible for the breach of GDPR. You are deploying equipment which breaches GDPR. Well, it's your responsibility to know what the equipment is doing and how it's configured. Wow. So in Europe, this is quite different, right? You are responsible for the implementation of what you do. It's like the sentence of, you know, the if you don't know the law, do you have the saying in English? We have a saying in Slovakian that the lack of knowledge of the law doesn't mean it doesn't
mean the
apply
law
to
doesn't
you.
Exist.
Yeah.
If you break it and you don't know it, it's law, where you're still, you know, we are still, yeah, there are still consequences to you,
yeah,
right?
I think our translation is ignorance of the law isn't a defense.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this puts system integrators and MSPs and everybody in Europe in a really awkward position. Also, Ubiquiti is not GDPR compliant, but then again, I don't think Ubiquiti has a official, maybe they do, official office in Europe. I think they have some development daughter company in Lithuania. I don't know if they, so for those of you who haven't been in this industry or who haven't kept up in the industry for long, there has been a lot of trading of development places in Ubiquiti. Like a lot of original Ubiquiti stuff was developed in Lithuania. People from there then moved to Ligowave. So Ligowave like bought off a bunch of offices of people from Ubiquiti in Lithuania. And then Ligowave merged with, whoever it was. This was years ago. Anyway, I don't remember if Ubiquiti still has some official offices or an official entity in Europe. If they do, then they might actually, there might be things which people or European governments can do to basically punish Ubiquiti for this. But if Ubiquiti doesn't have any official entities in Europe anymore, then they're a US traded company and you can't sue in the US for breach of European law, right? In the US they are compliant. So it's quite complicated.
That is very complicated.
Type of risks do the people that aren't aware this is happening on their systems that have to be compliant, what are the risks that they could deal with If they're, if, you know, if they happen to get legal ramification for this somehow.
And I mean, this has to be 99% of people, right? Most people are not going to have a clue that any of this is. I wouldn't have known unless you guys told me. So,
no.
Yeah, this is why the way they have done it is an issue, and why people are bringing this in relation to GDPR, right? Because it puts that responsibility, it puts that risk at the end user, which, well, is not not ideal. Anyway, so yeah, for as for ramifications, GDPR has quite clear ramifications. There is a the penalty if you breach GDPR. There is multiple levels of penalty depending on the severity of the breach. At the worst case, it's actually 3% of the company yearly revenue, which is quite ridiculous, as you can imagine. This is where the penalties for Google, if you saw, Google got billed like the biggest, I think it was 2 billion euro in penalty last year because of a GDPR, or was it Facebook? I think that was actually Facebook that got...
Yeah, I think that was...
Yeah, that was Facebook that got billed, you know, for 2 billion euros penalty because of GDPR breach. So you can see it can be really high. Like Europe is trying to force companies to sort out their, you know, their handling of private user data.
If you get hit with like a $2 billion fine, who gets that money?
So this particular one, I think because, so this is kind of more complicated because of taxation reasons. So there is, you know, most of technological companies that have entities in Europe, which are originally from US, like Facebook, Google, Microsoft, whoever else, they're actually based in Ireland. And there are multiple taxation avoidance schemes in Europe, which there is a double Irish, there is a Irish, Cyprus, Irish sandwich, and stuff like that. They have funny names. So most of these big tech companies are actually based in Ireland because they can use these tax avoidance schemes, which there has been a lot of talk if this should be regulated, if it should not be regulated, how much power should the European Union have over the taxational laws of Ireland as a country, because you know, it's the usual talk of, you know, like you have in the US, the federal laws versus the local state level laws and stuff like that. But the point is, since Facebook is in Europe, headquartered in Ireland, the GDPR lawsuit was in Ireland, and therefore the Irish government got the tasty $2 billion.
Man, those guys win, and then they win, and then they win. It's ridiculous.
GDPR is a serious thing. So as for my personal opinion, I actually really like GDPR. I think it's a good thing. I am not saying it's perfect by far. It has quite a few issues. It is legislature after all, and any legislature will have issues and will not be perfect. But I think it's a really good thing. I am really happy we have it in Europe. I use it commonly. I deal with it. It's not that hard once you get versed in it. Also, we don't really have things in Europe like robocallers or, you know, stuff like you guys have in the US with the random calls and telemarketers and everything else.
We
just don't have that in Europe. And that is because your phone number is considered personally and identifiable data under GDPR, so it can't be traded anymore. And actually, by law, if anybody calls you and you ask them, you know, where do you have my phone number from, they are by law required to answer this. And because this is GDPR protected, you know, how did you get a hold of my personally identifiable information of my phone number? If they don't answer well, you can actually sue them under GDPR, right? So, like, this is one actual really nice use case of GDPR where it has affected all of our lives in a positive way, because we don't have telemarketers, we don't have robocallers, and stuff like that. So I am really happy we have it. I use it commonly, I deal with it commonly. I think it's a good thing, although it's not perfect like anything else, and that's just my personal stance on it.
Yeah, nothing that the government puts in place is perfect, right? If man creates it, it's imperfect and will break at some point, so. But something's better than nothing. You know what? I've been getting a ton of robocalls, and I'll pick up, and it's just a Chinese woman on a recording. I've been getting so many of those. It's crazy. And like at work, we've got, I don't know, 300 DIDs or something, and they'll just start rolling across our DID blocks. It's just super weird. I don't know. Does Chinese spam, I mean, is that profitable here in the U.S.? It just seems strange that I don't know that many people coming off our zip code that's, you know, Chinese.
I've had to turn the option on my iPhone that basically silences any calls that aren't in my contacts because it got so bad. But a lot of the places out here, these rural communities, there's people all the time getting hit by Windows. They get called by Windows because their personal computer is infected. I mean, there's at least three people in this little town here of a couple hundred people that have been paying Indian scammers for 2 years. So it must be successful, but, you know, without something like that in place, legislation-wise, it's going to be hard to stop. I know they're trying to have some sort of, like, signature-based system with the carriers so that phone numbers have some sort of fingerprint that's identifiable, and if it doesn't match, the calls aren't supposed to be routed, but I don't know how realistic that's going to be, especially with, you know, VoIP and the way that you can just put any phone number in there and make a phone call. So I think something like GDPR would be super important to be able to just get rid of that.
I think maybe something I used to do on our phone system was a handful of numbers, like especially like elevator phones and stuff, you know, like backup lines for that, like POTS lines that would go to an elevator. So if you're in an emergency, you can hit the button. Well, people would dial into those and the elevator auto answers. And so you're just sitting there listening to a spam call while you're in the elevator. So I set it so that there was a call handler that a whole bunch of these things would call in and it would say, hey, just press 1 to continue. And that would cut out pretty much all of it because these automated systems would never, you know, just press 1. So got rid of a ton of that stuff.
That's really easy to fix. Just put some AI onto it and, you know, it's just some text or speech recognition and send the right commands. You wouldn't even need to recognize that much just to be able to answer basic prompts.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but nobody ever does it. So.
Yeah, and that increases their cost per call by at least 2 cents, and then your profitability goes through the tank.
You know, I came up with this idea, golly, probably like 12 years ago, and called it like the dungeon. The idea being that you could have a service where you would get, you know, all of your friends, you put out on the internet, put like a publicly available phone number that if somebody ever gets like a spam phone call, you know, you got them on the line, say, oh, hang on just a second, I'll transfer you over. And you transfer them to this line, and it will randomly match up spam callers, you know, and then they'll like, they'll just like start fighting each other. Or you could do like the dungeon where it's like a choose your own adventure, and they'll go in there and they'll have to like listen to the story and then answer, right? And then, you know, like if they fight this monster and defeat him, then, you know, they'll keep moving through. And if they last long enough, then they'll actually make it, and you'll talk to them or something like that. And it would record all the conversations and then put them up, you know. And I was thinking that would be awesome. I'm sure there's something by now, but I'm sure somebody could whip something up in Asterisk that would just be too good, too cool for school.
See, for me, those phone calls, I'll just in the nicest voice say, "I'm doing great. I'm going to be doing really great, even better now that you're never going to call me again." And pretty frequently the guys get pretty angry and or hang up. And sometimes though, they'll be like, you know, I don't really want to be doing this or something before I hang up on them. It's like, well, I feel sorry for them somewhat, but their job is to annoy me. So I don't mind annoying them back.
Yeah. Usually I just say that guy died. It was last week. It was tragic. You know, just come up with some story. Or he embezzled a bunch of money from the company, and if you have any idea where he actually is, let us know. And you know, you just make it as awkward as possible.
Well, there's also a lot of India-based call centers where a lot of the entry-level people that are doing the calling don't know that they're part of a scam company. Like, they think they're supposed to be like a tech support service, because a lot of them, they say they're from like Windows, or they're Windows certified, but they do sell like support contracts, and they think they're actually doing the job. And then they get raided, they all get arrested, and then the people that started it just start another one. Apparently it's a huge problem, and the government's getting involved over there. But yeah.
All right, let's talk about more interesting, less depressing things. Let's talk about, while we're on Ubiquiti still-ish, let's talk about some of the hardware they just released. They put out the Unify LTE gateway, which I think is neat. MicroTik put out their WAP LTE stuff. I mean, that stuff's been around a couple of years from MicroTik, right? So the very inexpensive alternative, like a cradle point or what have you, that will fail over. I don't think anybody actually uses LTE as their primary anywhere that I know of, although it's supposedly getting more affordable. But for now, Ubiquiti partnered with AT&T, which sounds right. It doesn't surprise me. But you can get a fairly decent deal on an AT. It comes with an AT&T SIM. What do they say? It's $15 a month. It comes with 1 gig. Overages are $10 for every additional gig. It's all UniFi-based, though, so you can't just grab it and configure it and plug it into any old thing. You actually have to configure it with UniFi. So I'm not sure how... Go ahead.
It won't work with any other SIM or any other provider. It's just you get the deal and that's it.
Yeah, AT&T only, right? So I wonder if you can... I mean, I guess this pairs with one of their UniFi routers, right? So that if the router loses its main internet connection, it'll kick over to this thing. Is that the idea? So you wouldn't be able to just like put a MicroTik in front of it and have it do the magic, or would you? I don't know. They're saying MSRP.
I think it's supposed to be like a
$200.
I think it's just supposed to be like an all-in-one unit. Like it's already pre-set up. You just, you know, pay for whatever the LTE stuff is, and it's easier to kind of get set up for a customer because there's a lot of offices where, I mean, I've had a couple customers that have several branch offices. You know, you set up IPsec tunnels for them so they can share assets across the networks, and then they have some guy that goes in and messes something up and takes a site down, and it's, you know, miles away from where he's located. It's like, hey, can you do anything about it? Well, you don't have any LTE backup or something for me to get into it, so it's kind of nice to have these types of products. I wanted to do the LTAP type units or any of the LTE MicroTik stuff for that, just so I always have like a way to get into the network if something happens like that. So I could see that be super valuable, at least to go in and fix the thing.
Yeah. Right now I'm doing MicroTiks with a Ting SIM card. Mm-hmm. And it's what, like $8 or $12 a month for each one of those?
And they just charge for pure usage, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I mean, there's like a SIM card charge, so it's like $8 a month or $10 a month. It's somewhere in that neighborhood. So it's not like crazy expensive, and it comes with X amount of bandwidth or whatever. But it's fairly inexpensive, and if it's just your out-of-band management and you almost never use it, then it's really cheap insurance, to be honest with you. Just a few cents a day if it could save you a truck roll. Or like you said, if the WAN goes down and you do need to get like at least the credit card transactions through, you know, or something like that.
Right.
It'll do that for sure.
What we used to do back when I was running the network in the before I started Unimus, we had like 10 4G connections all around the network in different various places. And when either, well, we had a primary and a secondary, you know, connections, which were big, fat optic pipes. But even then, it would happen that both of them died at the same time. So we had like 10 different LGs stashed across the network. And so when the primary connections died, everything would just reroute like to the closest 4G backup connection. So and the point was to have it all across the network for, well, to spread the data load and, of course, to spread the speed load. But that's one really nice, like, last ditch effort to keep a network up. You just spread a bunch of super cheap 4G connections around and just OSPF takes care of it.
But if you lost both of your upstreams, doesn't that mean most of the people in your town lost their upstreams as well? Like if they happen to... So, I mean, I'm just wondering if the cell network started getting clogged really fast.
Yeah. It's not perfect, but you have connectivity, which is better than you don't.
Saying, I have no idea why it happens, but... This one customer has 10 gateways and they crash our network every time.
No, these were like 15 gigs, I think, each, right? So it wouldn't last long, right? We had, I think, 10. Later on, I think we had like 13 or 14 of them stashed across the network. So it was like, you know, definitely not Netflix capable or anything else. And it was just last ditch effort. Like all the customers were shaped, you know, there was a PCQQ that, right, you know, obviously shaped everyone to the lowest possible speed, but the network worked.
Right. Something was better than nothing.
Yeah. And it was super low effort, right? When you have OSPF set up, it's just a default gateway like any other, right? Just with a much higher path cost. And so, you know, it's not like it's magic. You just place default gateways across the network, and when the primary ones fail, then the network automatically reroutes everything to the closest possible one. And yeah.
All right. So let's see. Moving on from their LTE products, they put out, and I think this was in the beta store already for a while, the Unified Dream Machine. Looks like a can of beans. Like, I mean, it's a pretty curvy, white, apple-ish can of beans.
So botulism?
Yeah, you know.
The can puffed out?
Dual band, 802.ac, 4x4, Wave 2, access point, 4-port gig switch built in. They're talking about how it does the IDS, IPS, deep packet inspection. Of course, whenever you enable that stuff, the router's throughput really goes down a lot. It says it's got a 1.7 gigahertz quad core processor. Retail about $300. It's cute looking. Just another router. I mean, it's very aesthetically pleasing for sure. I don't know that it's a great departure from their other edge router products, really. I mean, you know, that kind of fit this mold. You guys have an opinion one way or the other?
It's a little. It's a nice, pretty can to send my data away.
Yeah.
It's pretty nice. But I think people care more about like aesthetics. So, I mean, even Microtech has those 3D printed, like, CAD markups, so you could, like, print cases for their router boards. I think people are trying to, even the audience, I mean, that's on the notes, I believe, right? People.
Yeah, yeah.
Justin, yeah, because I think it looks awesome. I think it's the prettiest looking Microtech product so far. I've tried to get one for a couple weeks, and yeah, I liked it, the way that they're designing these really cool antenna systems, but in a pretty looking product that you can kind of just put out in the open.
Yeah, it's very, and you don't generally hear this thing in the same sentence as the word Microtech, but it's very aesthetically pleasing, right? It looks like almost like a vase / piece of modern art. So it's chunky. It's got a giant heat sink. I mean, it's a good piece of kit. I actually got one from ISP Supplies. Steve Disher was nice enough to supply me with a review sample. So thank you, Steve, for sure. I know Colin Z has been doing a lot of playing with his audience. I think Cox has been playing with his audience a lot. That sounds weird when you say it like that.
Playing with his audience.
I think both of those guys did the meshing feature, right? So it's got 2 5-gig radios, one that's 4-chain that's for meshing to another one, and then one that's just 2-chain for clients or whatever. So I guess for client wise, it's almost like connecting to a half AC squared, right, as far as client experience goes. But I, so far it's been really solid for me. I haven't seen any hiccups. It's more powerful than what I had in before. It seems like a good radio. I know whenever I'm on the pooper, I get great signal now, so that actually,
congratulations. Better,
which is, you know, it's like the farthest,
that's what matters, right?
It's the farthest point where, you know, that kind of thing really does impact your quality of life. So yes, it's
very important.
It's good. Yeah, so I've seen improvement. I like it so far. Yeah.
And I think the next one on your list is the UAP beacon, right?
Yeah
which is to make that work even better.
Yeah, so another Ubiquiti product. I thought they usually space these things out a little bit, but they've been putting out a lot here recently. And this one is a meshing AP only. I was curious about the nature of it until I looked at the pictures, and when you see the back of it, all it has is a built-in plug. So like an electrical socket plug. So you really just cover some socket somewhere in a room. You just, you know, just cover it right over there and just shove that guy in, and it'll mesh back into the network. On my unified deployments, I always go into all the APs and turn off meshing feature, because if you've got a unified AP and somehow it maintains power but loses network connectivity, it'll mesh to something else. And I have had nothing but problems with that. And I've seen other people inadvertently have loops in their networks because of that. Just weird, just weird stuff happens. So I generally turn it all off. So the idea of a mesh only product doesn't super appeal to me, but I 100% see it for that unified profile, right? So if you had a unified customer, you could say, you know what, it's dead over in that area, just go grab this thing and just shove it in, plug it in, and Bob's your uncle, you're done, right? So
yeah, maybe I have a pure hatred for wireless extenders like that. I the last like 4 months, almost every single time I get a phone call, I, at least 80% of the time, there's a wireless extender that's starting to cause that is the beginning of their problems. And it's just,
or they're like, yeah, I put it in the part of the house where my signal was weak, and it's not helping. My Wi-Fi bars are full.
yeah,
three floors across the house where my Xbox is. I plugged it in. I have full bars, but it's slow.
Yeah. I don't understand.
That's why I like the audience so much. You know, having a dedicated backhaul card to connect them together. I mean, sometimes it's kind of a pain to actually recable a building, but now these consumer products are coming available that, you know, you've got dedicated backhaul interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as the spectrum's good, I mean, you don't really need to hardwire the house. Slap a couple of those things in there. Yeah. You can get pretty good speeds.
Yeah, I think I've given up on the idea of wiring houses. Wi-Fi deployments crazy. Have just gotten so good here recently.
Yeah, we just do. We've been doing a lot of power line adapters, especially now that Microtik has their power line adapter line, and that like gives you the information. It's just that's my go-to these days. Like if somebody has a TV that like they don't want to put next to the router for whatever stupid reason, I just power line adapter to the TV, because TV Wi-Fi is just so, especially if they have like an off-brand TV, it's just not worth it to fight with it.
Interesting. They've been really consistent for you then?
Yeah. I've had lots of really good success.
Booyah. All right.
So
I was curious about those. I haven't really played with them much, because I mean, my only experience was just the cheap Chinese ones from mm-hmm. 10 years ago or whatever. And they were just, yeah, you know, I mean, just your mileage may vary sort of situation. So,
mm-hmm. Your mileage may vary a little bit, because just depending on the house, how the house is wired. So you got to keep that in mind. And mm-hmm. sometimes I have to do power line to power line, then wireless across the room or across from one room to another to get on another circuit and then be able to get down. I had one house that I had to get kind of complicated with it, but it was three stories of in-floor aluminum heating, in-floor heating. And it was all aluminum pipe ran through the whole bloody thing. So Wi-Fi just didn't carry anywhere. And it's just,
sounds like a interesting Rube Goldberg Wi-Fi contraption you've created.
I had to. The people that built this house, it was a horribly designed for modern life. Mm. So
man, you know, as I'm scrolling through these Ubiquiti products, they are so aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah.
There's something about it that just, I don't know, they look like
the user interface too.
Delicious pieces of chewing gum or something, you know, they're just all just curvy and happy.
Yeah. AC equipment like looks nice, you know, nicer at least in a lot of ways.
You can see really the influence, like it's the Apple design, right? And right. I mean, also, this is what I mentioned when, you know, I am not the end customer for Ubiquiti. I think they're really going after those, you know, not technical users anymore, rather just those, you know, like, I don't know how to call the right user group, but enthusiasts, I would guess, tech enthusiasts and people who are after those aesthetically pleasing interfaces and products, but are not necessarily technical. And you can see it shows, in those designs of hardware, of software, but also of what their software does and when they're going with it. And I agree. They are definitely doing the right thing for their target market.
Yeah.
Even just like the half tech, or I think we should be careful, because like half a technical, like, Thomas, you're technically a god when it's considered, when we talk about technical.
Giving me too much credit, man. No. Too much credit.
I know, it's all the microchips installed in his head. It doesn't count.
But superhuman. You do need to have a little bit of knowledge of how things work to be able to set up Ubiquiti well.
No, I'm not saying like it's not not for it's mm-hmm. still not for end users.
Yeah.
But there is a difference of being like a generalist IT person, or mm-hmm. you know, of doing the desktop support, or doing, you know, some Windows server stuff maybe, or you know, mm-hmm. but you have never heard of networking. And you don't know any of the networking particularities, I think you can still set up most of the Ubiquiti equipment just fine.
Yeah.
Or even I see use cases really frequently, as in somebody will come in, they'll do the initial install, they get everything, you know, put up and programmed, and then just turn over the interface to the end customer, because it is pretty enough to load up the home screen and look at the dashboard and kind of get an idea of what's going on. Oh, the access point's red, it's not on. Or, you know, they can go in there and change the password on their SSID. So they, and I don't know very many people where I could set up like a MikroTik configuration and know that they could jump into Winbox or WebFig and make those changes without completely bricking something.
You actually could with WebFig skins. It's just that nobody uses them. You know, when you create a WebFig skin, you actually have the option of enabling and disabling each individual button in WebFig. So I have actually done this before for some users. When they log in into WebFig, all they see is a single screen that says Wi-Fi password.
Hmm.
You can do this on MikroTik with WebFig skins. It's just that nobody bothers to. And it's still not pretty, right? It's still WebFig.
Right.
I'm not saying it's pretty, but you can make it functional even for non-technical users. It's just that, yeah, Ubiquiti, it just works out of box. It is pretty, and it's just a much more complete package for that use case.
Hmm. Fair enough.
They want to send an installer out with the radio, open up the phone app, discovers the management interface, goes, hey, which AP do you want to connect to? This one. Type in the password, check your signal, and go.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying, right? It's
right.
I'm not saying like you need to have a complete deep in knowledge of all the networking stacks and protocols and everything else.
Right.
What I meant is that yeah, you can be just like a generalist IT person or just somebody who knows very little, and it's enough to give you the ability to set up most of the Ubiquiti products, which ties back to their customer base and their target market. And they are doing it right for that target market.
For sure.
You can argue with it. They have results there.
So do you want to do an issue of Today I Learned, Thomas, on your IPv6 sure. tracing?
Yeah, that one was fun.
Well, tell us about it.
This just proves that I don't know everything. Nobody knows everything. And there is always something to learn. So I had a quite funny story with this, that I was setting up IPv6. We were changing from PPPoE to a static IPv6 deployment with a routed block because we purchased some additional blocks for our main office of Unimus. And don't get me started on the entire issue, but previously we were completely happy and functional on PPPoE, both V4 and V6, but the provider wanted to migrate us to, you know, not PPPO with static IP and just, you know, EOIP for both connections. So I was migrating our IPv6 and adding some additional routed subnets to V4, and I was tracing my IPv6 address, the loopback one, which is the routed one, not the connecting subnet, but the routed loopback, and I couldn't trace it. And ping worked, I just couldn't trace it, and I couldn't figure out why. And so, as it turns out, I was using TracePath, the TracePath utility in Linux. So there is multiple tracing utilities in Linux. There is TracePath, there is TraceRoute. Those ones are protocol independent, so they will automatically pick up whether to V4 or V6. And then you have their respective, it's TraceRoute 4 and TraceRoute 6 and TracePath 4 and TracePath 6, right? And it just wouldn't work from whatever Linux servers, we run Ubuntu server everywhere. So from whichever one I tried, it wouldn't work and I couldn't figure out why. And so as it turns out, all you need is just to RTFM. So when you look into the man page for TracePath and TraceRoute on Ubuntu, it actually tells you that the tracing is done over UDP, not ICMPv6. So of course, our MikroTik in firewall, we deny any, you know, any incoming connections which are not established from unknown IPs, right? It's just standard input firewall protection. And so that was, of course, dropping the UDP packets, which the TracePath utility was using for tracing. And this took me good, I think, 2 hours to figure out, because I was looking everywhere else. You know, I was looking at the configuration of V6, I was looking at the firewalls, I was looking everywhere on the router and the networking. I didn't look in the man page of the of the utility I was using. So for some reason, the TracePath and TraceRoute utilities in Ubuntu use UDP by default, and they don't have ICMPv6 compiled in. So there is no way in Ubuntu to do a ICMPv6 trace out of the box. And so this is what I learned. So you have to be careful what protocol you're using for tracing. It will not necessarily be ICMPv6. So of course, my next step was just to use MTR. And as it turns out, the MTR, which comes from the distribution packages in Ubuntu, does actually use IP and ICMPv6, and that worked and traced properly. And so then I think it was Trift, or maybe it was Alex actually, who asked that, why am I even using TracePath in the first place instead of MTR? And that's another interesting thing, is because MTR doesn't do PMTUD, path MTU discovery, which TracePath does, which I really like, because if you run TracePath, it will show you which hop along the way is squeezing your MTU and what your end-to-end MTU is, which is super useful to know, and MTR doesn't tell you that.
Very cool. Very cool. So how much time do you think you wasted tracking that one down?
Yeah, about 2 hours.
It's one of those black holes you fall into. I love those. They're so fun. Because you're not busy. So, you're always just farting around.
Yeah, of course. I've got time. I've got time on my hands to spend 2 hours to...
Why else would you be sitting here talking to me, obviously?
So that was a really good educational enterprise that hopefully this will save somebody else the 2 hours of looking through stuff. And I mean, as I said, it clearly states it in the man page that it uses UDP for tracing. Right. It's just
the man page that nobody reads. I get it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, while we're close to Thomas's rant corner, how about you tell us about why you went to Linux desktop only at Unimus?
So yeah, this is a funny one, and it's still a little bit of a work in progress, but yeah, we've now instituted a Linux only policy in the company. So we are a software company, we do software development, of course, and up until now it was up to everyone in the company if they want to run Linux on Windows or Windows on their desktops. Of course, all our servers are Linux. But so I migrated my desktop to Linux, and I think we talked about it about half a year ago, maybe.
Yeah.
Was it? I think it's already is like half a year ago. And I have been very happy with it. I have been very few problems. Everything runs great. I don't have to deal with crappy Windows patches and them, you know, Microsoft screwing up patch Fridays or the constant 0 days that are present in Windows and everything around this. Also, we don't have to pay licenses and deal with licensing and everything else that comes with it. So we talked it internally, or we talked about it internally in the company, and we decided that, yeah, we will enforce a Linux desktop only policy in the company. And so this, we are in process of doing this. We started with the technical users, with the developers, our Scrum Master, and other technical stuff. That's been going quite well, actually. Surprisingly, very few issues. There have been issues. I'm not going to say there weren't. It's still... so Windows... Once you are used to all the Windows quirks and you have your workflow figured out in Windows and you do switch to a Linux desktop, there is a little bit of a learning curve. I'm not going to say there isn't, but it's a very minor learning curve. There are some things which you have to, you know, pick up the Linux quirks. It's not as comfortable out of the box as Windows. You can configure the heck out of it. This is Linux. You can do anything with it, right? But out of the box, some things I wish were a little bit different. But yeah, it's been going really well so far, actually. So far we've migrated. There is now 5 Linux desktops in our company, and there is 3 Windows desktops left. The next step is migrating the non-technical users, like our billing department, office management, purchasing, and whatever else. Those will be more interesting, I would say. So if anybody is interested what we have decided on, we are running Manjaro KDE on the desktops. It's super pretty, it works really well out of the box, it's a rolling release, so you're always on the latest, greatest drivers, kernel, software. It's super pretty. It's prettier than Windows, really, and it's still super configurable. And so yeah, updates to come on this story now that we will be migrating those non-technical users. It should get interesting. But it's funny because one of our developers actually, after a couple of days of having a Linux desktop at work, he decided to migrate his home laptop that he uses for his personal use to a Linux desktop, because he said he likes it so much, it works, and he's, you know, this is a laptop he uses like once a month, and he said, yeah, it got to the point where he turned it on once a month, and the first thing it did, it updated for an hour. And then he didn't need it anymore because it did what he needed to do on his desktop, and it completely killed, you know, that for him. So it's been going well. I can say, yeah, Linux desktop in 2019, very good place. We like it, all of us. No deal breakers so far in our story, with more updates to come.
Gotcha. Like a normal muggle like me, I've had the same workflow for like the last 12 years, you know, and I'm really fast. I know all my keyboard shortcuts. I'm very quick at what I do. I'm very efficient, not lazy. I'm efficient, right? There's a difference. Would you suggest it for somebody like me, or do you think, you know, maybe it's not necessarily a use case for every technical guy, or are you really evangelizing this? Where are you at on that?
So, it depends if you feel like you can give it enough time for you to earn back that time. Because there will be a learning period, right? But after that learning period is over, trust me, your productivity, your effectivity will go up in heaps. And I mean it. Like, things, before my coworkers migrated to Linux, I set them down, I showed them how I do things down at the desktops, and you actually look like a wizard. You are just pressing shortcuts and things are happening, windows are moving and stuff is happening, and like, what is even happening? Like, you can do stuff 5 times faster than on Windows due to the ability of being able to bind any action, any application, anything to the keyboard. And you can do customizable shortcuts. Like, if you don't like some behavior, you can change it. Whereas in Windows, it is what it is, right? So, but to get to that point, it of course requires a little bit of learning, a little bit of time investment, and customizing the environment. Because so if you have some particular like workflow, you can entirely replicate that workflow in Linux, but it won't work out of the box. it won't. The shortcuts are a little bit different, or shortcuts which you are used to might do different things. So you will have to either adjust the environment to your workflow or adjust your workflow to the environment. And that hurdle, and after you do that, you can improve the workflow. You can, for example, each time I want to open LastPass, my password manager, right? I have to find a Chrome window. I have to click on the little widget thing, you know, the icon. Well, in Linux, I have bound that to a single key press. So I do Control Alt E and it spawns my LastPass vault immediately. That's like good 5 to 10 seconds I have saved each time I need to access my LastPass vault. Or, you know, if I want to SSH to a server, it's Control-Alt-S, and it spawns a searchable list of my SSH sessions. So it's just like Control-Alt-S, test, portal, enter, and immediately I'm inside of some SSH session. Or I have a, you know, like you have Alt-Tab in Windows. And when you have many windows, Alt-Tabbing actually takes time because you have to visually process all the tabs inside of the Alt-Tab switcher, and then you have to navigate to the one you want. And that takes time. Mm. In Linux, what I have done is I have Alt-Tilde, and this gives me a searchable text list of my windows, and I type the first three letters of a window and hit enter, and it switches to that window. And this takes longer to describe than it does because it's like magic. You just do Alt-Tilde, F-I-R, enter. You can do that in half a second and you have the Firefox window, right? And it's like little things like those, they stack up. They really do. And when you adjust your workflow to that and you show it to someone, you really are like a wizard. Just things are flying around, windows are switching, stuff is opening. And
So
yeah.
Have you graphed the amount of time you've saved, or is it in a pie chart? I'm just curious which
representation. No, I haven't. I haven't like officially measured it, but you feel it. You really feel it. Like you do things faster. You remove the bloat. You know, the waiting for Windows to open, the waiting for your brain to process what is on the screen, because you don't need to. Like with the text switching of Windows, you know, Alt-Tilde, first three letters, enter. Your eyes don't, you could do this with your eyes closed, right? And it's a very different, we could talk about, you know, how your brain processes information and visual versus text versus cue-based navigation and stuff like that. But to get back to the point, right? I think everybody should at least try it, but you shouldn't fight it. You shouldn't try to make a Linux desktop into a Windows. I think that is the wrong approach. I think everybody should try it if you actually want to, if this sounds enticing to you at all, and if it sounds like, yeah, I think I could, you know, I think I can live with maybe a week or a couple of weeks adjustment period, and after that I know my workflow, my efficiency, my performance will go up. If this sounds like something that you could do, then I think you should try.
All right. Well, I mean, Microsoft's starting to put Linux into their Windows operating systems, right? And I think the Linux console,
that's different.
What?
Yeah, that's different.
Do you think one day maybe they'll just jump the shark and just move over to it completely?
I don't think so. It's way different. It's just the entirety of how Linux is structured, how the Linux desktop works and everything else. It's way different than Windows on a technical level. And I think adjusting Linux to be like Windows, I don't think that's, as I said, I don't think that's the right approach. So I don't think Microsoft will ever choose that approach either.
Hmm. All right, T-Cent, what's your thoughts on this?
Oh, well, I was just going to mention to Thomas that Windows actually sends out a proper ICMP with its ping v6.
just throwing it out there. A little bit. Twist it.
I've had Linux like boner friends for so many years that I stick with Windows every time. It's like, yeah. I'm getting more and more used to running Linux, especially like for server stuff. I've got a VM server now that hosts all of our stuff, and it's so nice. Just that I can spin up a new Ubuntu or CentOS and whatever, and I don't have to deal with that licensing or any of that. That is super, super nice. And just like firewall stuff is really nice. System CTL, that's eh. I'll get used to it eventually, but I don't know, man. It's the I like it for server stuff, and I can't say I wouldn't be using it for personal stuff if I didn't game.
You know what also I'm thinking about is, as you're saying that, is if I actually had a Linux machine that was my daily driver and I was on it all the time, I bet my server infrastructure would benefit greatly from that, because I only touch it on servers, right? So I'm just not using it day in and day out. So I'm sure there's a lot I'm missing, right, that I could really benefit from. You know, it's kind of that forced exposure. You know, like they say, if you want to learn a language, you go and immerse yourself in it in some country, right? You just drop yourself in there. And I'm assuming it would be the same thing for any Linux distribution.
Yep, very much so.
All right. We're at an hour and a half. You guys ready to stick a fork in it?
Sure.
Sure.
Excellent. Hopefully there's pizza waiting out there for me. I heard the door knock. I heard Christy go to it. That means there's probably pizza. So, Nick Arellano is not here, but if he was here, he would say email him at nick@arellano.net, I think is where he's at. You can also grab him on the Brothers with Slack. He is really good about answering ats if you throw an ad in there, or really just anything in general. He's really good at that. Tommy, if somebody wants to get a hold of you out on the internet, how would you have them do that? What's your preferred method?
If you have Mimosa questions, or if you just want to get a hold of me, the Mimosa forums, I'm William5 there. I get that. I answer those questions, and the Mimosa people are really thankful for that. So I'm now modded on their forums. So if you have any questions there, feel free to reach out to me for that, or on the Brothers with Slack, particularly in the Slack 10K issue. Anybody who's a little brother, join, get in that channel and freaking get your opinions out there, because dagnabbit, this is like, this question needs to be solved.
It's, you know, been it's funny for so I was long. Having a conversation about this with somebody else, and based on the conversation, they were like, you know what, actually it's probably good that we have the 10K limit, that people can't say or can't see what somebody said here and there and there and there. So I don't know. Some people maybe don't want all of that to live in perpetuity.
Yeah. I definitely have a little
of
bit
good,
of
good, but there's some of it, you know. Memes, you know, they don't hold well over time. So you really want that stuff to go by the wayside. Which my new favorite meme is Kids Bop Karen. I put it in there. I don't know if you guys saw it. It is the best. So I'll give you the quick and dirty. There's this lady who some Uber driver cut her off, and she's like losing her stuff on the lady in the back seat of the Uber, and it's amazing. There's been some amazing remixes on it. But if you look at her, she is like exhibiting the most bizarre behavior. And I was listening to Dr. Drew, and he said, if you can see the white above somebody's eye, so if you look at yourself in the mirror, your eyelid will cover a little bit of your pupil up there, right? You know, whatever is the colored part of your eye, you know, and that's a normal state for people. But he said, if you can see that, that usually is one of three things. He said, either they usually have a thyroid problem, it's meth, or mania. So they're in like a manic state. So that lady, you could see every bit of the top of the whites of her eyes, man. Like you had a good 3 or 4 millimeters. So that chick was ready to snap. She was going crazy. Probably sitting.
I like it how you use millimeters.
Ooh, yeah. Well, whenever I'm measuring stuff precisely, I use my calipers and I always leave them in millimeters. That's 11.
All right, progress. We are converting you.
As soon as I got a 3D printer, I started using a metric system.
Good.
Let's see. If you want to get a hold of me, greg@gregsoul.com. That's my email. You can go to gregsoul.com, where I very occasionally blog. Really, the easiest way is on the Little Brothers with Slack. Unfortunately, I missed like a day and a half the other day, and it took me 45 minutes to catch up most of the way. There's just so much stuff going on in there now. It's hard to miss and come back. There's no like digest feature where you can just quickly catch up, but it's all good. I mean, I learn a lot. A lot of it doesn't really pertain to me, but I pick up enough to where I could say, hey, I heard somebody say, maybe you probably shouldn't do that or this or that. So it's very useful one way or the other, even when you guys are talking about stuff that I have no idea what you're talking about, which is most of the time, probably. But yeah, you want to become a little brother, patreon.com/brotherswisp. Do that. Questions, comments, send them our way. If you guys have any future topics you'd like to hear about, if you have an interesting story, I'd love to hear about it. We did the tips video. Tommy C over there was talking about the tip stuff. I'm still looking to do those. I haven't had anybody step up to the plate in a while, but wouldn't mind recording one of those. So I guess, again, thank you. I didn't do Thomas. Thomas, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
As usual, just Google for me. You'll find me on all the social networks and everything else. Of course, there's the Slack, and of course, there's unimus.net. We have Unimus live chat, so feel free to just ask for me at Unimus.
Can I send you ASCII art on your live chat? Is that acceptable?
That's a communication? Good question. Nobody has tried yet.
Get in there.
I don't know if it would work. I don't know what the character limit is. I don't know what the formatting is. We have a mystery on our hands.
I'm sure somebody will solve it. All right. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Thomas. Thank you, Tommy. Thomas, Tommy. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Nick, who was here earlier, but is in the process of moving, so his stuff is kind of all whack. And he had to jump off. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.